I'm sure we've all been very blessed with Bob's discourses in the past, and we're going to be blessed again today with a topic of spiritual perspectives. Spiritual perspectives, Brother Bob.
Thank you, Brother Rick, and good morning, everyone. We finally have a winter day in Florida. I was up early this morning and it was in the 30s, so it was rather invigorating. Spiritual perspectives is what we're going to talk about today, and we're going to kind of contrast that with earthly perspectives. Now, we live in both grand and awful times, and we've seen many, many events in this new year of 1999. We're just getting used to writing 1999 on our checks and our other things. We're already 45 days into this new year. As I was thinking about a subject of what to talk on, I thought about many of the current events that are happening in our world today, as well as our earlier study where we're thinking about things on the memorial. So we thought we would kind of bring some of these current events in, give you the earthly and the spiritual perspective, as well as focusing in on spiritual things with regard to memorial. Today is Valentine's Day. It's a day of celebration of love and romance. How many have gotten flowers or a phone call or a card? You know, when we think about Valentine's Day, the world thinks about love, romance, and so forth. And this is that Eros love, and it's not a bad thing. It's really the part of the fabric of what helps to hold our family units together. But do any of you know about the background of Valentine's Day? I'll give you what I found out. Originally, we're told that during the early Christian era, the commander of Roman soldiers wanted his soldiers to be more focused. And he found out the ones that were married tended not to want to go into battle. So he came up with a good idea. He decided he would discourage marriage, not only discourage it, but he forbid any of the early Christian priests to conduct marriage ceremonies. Quite an extreme measure. The priest was a priest named by the name of Valentine, and he decided to disobey it, so he married several of the soldiers to their sweethearts. Well, when the commander found out, he had him thrown in jail. In fact, he was under penalty of death. As a little twist, during the time that he was in jail, he got to know the commander's sister. And so they started to write. And over a period of time, they wrote letters back and forth to each other. Well, just before his death, this priest named Valentine sent a card or a letter and signed it, "Your Valentine." So it's said that this is how the Valentine's wish started. Now, later in the early church, he was declared Saint Valentine. And this holiday just happened to correspond with a pagan springtime ritual and rite of fertility. And, you know, the early church liked to combine things. We know about Easter. It's like, well, we'll take the pagan, we'll take the, quote, Christian, we'll roll them together, and we get the best of both worlds. So that's kind of the background of the holiday that we now call Valentine's Day. But what should the church's perspective be? First of all, just like Easter, we realize there's some good underpinnings, but there's also some pagan roots in this celebration of Valentine's Day. And really, we can rejoice with the world just like at Christmas when they celebrate our Lord's birth, and we go, well, they got the date wrong or the time of year wrong, but it's good that they're celebrating. We can rejoice in celebrating in a day like this. But really, when we think about it from a Christian standpoint, the type of love that we're talking about, the spiritual standpoint, is much deeper. And we really find that laid out for us in 1 Corinthians in the 13th chapter, in the first 7th verses. And we're all familiar with these. I'm going to remind you and refresh your memories. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 7. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, or if you've got other translations, it will say love, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and have all knowledge, and although I have all faith that I could move mountains and have not charity or love, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and I give my body to be burned, and have not love or charity, it profiteth me nothing. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, and is not puffed up. It doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not its own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil. It rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, and endureth all things. So from a Christian perspective, this is the love that we are talking about. This is the love that we seek to cultivate. And I think, you know, in our earlier meeting, we talked a little bit about brotherly love. And we also got into talking about love of even our enemies. Love is described as disinterested love. It's really, that may be a term that's a little bit unclear, but it's love where nothing is expected in return. Love of even our enemies. This is the love that we need to cultivate and see from a spiritual perspective. Another event that I think all of us are well aware of, unless we've been hibernating for the last year, and that's the impeachment. It's finally over. On Friday, they finally finished it. For the past year, the media has been consumed with this story. You couldn't turn on the news anywhere and not hear about it. We heard about it when we were at an international convention in Europe. It was the major story and focus on the United States when we were in Australia. And, of course, every night you turned it on, it was on. No details were spared. Did you notice that? It's a little different than it used to be in years past. There was no discretion. No details were spared. And a recent poll said the majority of Americans were just sick and tired of the whole thing. They wanted it to be done. It shows that there has been a change in the media. We have scriptures to support this, that there will be a time when they will delve into all things. All things will be revealed. It showed very much that the people in general were very frustrated with the justice system. It's interesting the conclusion they came to. He was not guilty on both charges by a simple majority. And yet, there are very few in the United States that would say he did not commit adultery and he did not lie. Justice is very frustrated, isn't it, from an earthly standpoint? Now what, from a spiritual perspective, have any of you gotten engaged in conversations with those in the world on this whole sordid matter? I mean, at one time or another, someone said something to you and you responded. How should we be looking at this from a spiritual perspective? I have to say, when I went back and looked at it from that perspective, I didn't handle it correctly in the past. First of all, we should pray for our leaders. You might say we should be praying for Clinton and Gore and the Republicans and the Democrats, but that's absolutely true, and we're told that directly in 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 3. I exhort you, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. For kings. Well, the president's not a king, but what he's saying here is leaders. And for them that are in authority, that they may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God. This is a very appropriate prayer at this time. It's showing that we need to continue to pray for our leaders. It's showing that God has placed these individual leaders in their positions of power at this time for specific reasons. Now, we have spiritual perspective, so we realize that it's part of a bigger plan. Those in the world do not. To those in the world, they're saying, well, history will judge this president. Should we be judging this president? How many of you have said statements one way or another on this about what you thought about this situation? We're told not to be judgmental. Now, do we have any precedents for that? Well, let's look back at some other biblical stories of very similar, if not more sordid, events. You'll remember in 2 Samuel in the 11th chapter, we have an individual there who was a murderer and an adulterer. Remember what his name was? Heard it on the front row. David. He admitted it. And this 11th chapter of 2 Samuel goes through and chronicles his gross sin. And yet he was used of God. He was fallen flesh as well. What about this situation? You know, as I pondered this situation, I thought back to a talk a number of years ago when I think I gave a talk on Israel and prophecy, and Brother George Ike, it was like a watch night service. Brother George Ike came in and talked on the current situation. And he helped frame it for me. In his talk, he discussed how did President Bush fall from favor in a six-month period. Remember, President Bush was in charge of Desert Storm, and he had the highest approval ratings of his entire presidency 6 months before the election. He had no scandals. There was no, the economy was okay. There was nothing really bad that would bring him to lower ratings to where Bill Clinton could get the election after that. So why did that happen? He made a comment that I think was very good. First of all, he said, in God's due time, things might have been moving too quickly or too slowly. Remember, Bush not only was involved with Desert Storm, but also a lot of the follow-on or the preceding stuff with the Soviet Union. And he was saying perhaps things were moving too quickly or too slowly, and God intervened and set up another leader. Because when you look at history, there's no real reason why he should go from the peak in the approval ratings down to the basement in a six-month period. It just didn't make sense. It wasn't yet time. So that means it would be time for Clinton. Now, why would Clinton be put in? He's been a fairly effective president. Why would he be disgraced like this? I mean, there's nobody in the government that would say he's not being disgraced. Terrible behavior, lack of self-control, lying, cheating, stealing, da-da-da-da-da, go on and on. But why is he disgraced? You know, I pondered this question. I think I heard the answer from a correspondent. He answered, remember, Clinton recently met with the Pope just a few weeks ago in Denver. And first of all, why in the heck would the Pope meet with a president that was in this scandalous state? Another question. The commentator described Clinton as the most powerful leader in the world. The commentator went on to say, and he was meeting with the moral leader of the world. Now, we find that objectionable, but this is what the world was saying. So we had a marriage here, illicit marriage. We had the most powerful leader with the one who was considered the most moral leader. Now, there's no way that you could consider Bill Clinton a moral leader. We realize that that's kind of a desert situation there, based on the record. But it has now elevated the Pope to being spoken of as the moral leader of the world. Interesting situation with regards to the rolling together of the scrolls and perhaps the eventual marriage of government and church for a short period of time. So we need to keep aware of these things. We're told in 2 Timothy 3:1 through 9, for this know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. That's today. We're in the last times. For men shall be lover of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce-breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. When I look at this whole situation and all the drama that is played out, all of the players, the prosecutor, the man who was to be the head of the majority for the Republicans, who got disqualified because of his indiscretions, when you look at the lying and the deceit and the immorality, it really shows you this is where we are. And these are government officials in the highest places, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. From such they turn away. For of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. We see that they're in a situation of darkness and gross darkness. Keep your eyes peeled. I think it's important that we look at these worldly events with spiritual eyesight. Now, what else is happening? Well, this week in the evening, going home from work late one evening, they had Jeb Bush, governor, talking about state government. And he brought up, of course, one of my favorite subjects, the year 2000. And he made a statement that I think will be very true. Someone had asked him about the preparedness of the state of Florida, and he gave him the stock answer that 97% of the critical systems were ready. Didn't say what critical meant. And then he made another statement, which I think will be very true. He said that in the next few weeks, after this impeachment mess gets over, you're going to see a lot of media focus and attention turn to the year 2000. And why is that? Because there's going to be a vacuum. The media has gone into a frenzy like we've never seen before. I don't think we've ever seen a media frenzy like covering this thing. But they've generated a lot of need for news. Now, what's going to be out there? Well, Ken Starr can keep doing his thing through June. But the year 2000 is also out there. I frequently get asked the question from the brethren, well, is it better or worse than when you last spoke? And my answer is always the same, it's worse. And I will give you a few examples. Now, you may not have heard of these lately because, quite frankly, everything has been focused on the impeachment. But here's off the technical press, confessions of a year 2000 victim of bank transactions already happening. JetForm, which is a JetForm corporation which does real quick forms, stock plunges 4,800. It says JetForm profit warning triggers stock meltdown. So their stock basically went down in half because of year 2000 preparedness statement. Cincinnati Post, year 2000 glitches already hit the auditor's office. County vehicles out of gas, foster parents not paid by the county, workers reassigned, incorrect paychecks, etc., etc., etc. These are already happening. Another good one. Class action suit woes. Compliance at price. Medical manager carries scars from year 2000 bug suit. Cost them $1.5 million. Almost put them out of business. Early victim of year 2000. Paychecks and W-2s. Another article. Closures blamed on year 2000. Three companies cite remediation costs and other filings show how they had to close their companies because they couldn't fix the problem. Utility bill delivers a shock. This was in Arizona. They basically charged about eight times more for utilities because they do an averaging over a year, and if they can't read your meter because of weather or whatever, they go ahead and give you the average. Well, the average went out and projected, and people were getting $500 and $600 utility bills and gas bills as a result when they had some bad weather. Year 2000 shuts down Prodigy Classic. 208,000 subscribers have to change. Computer flaw triggers early data release from a producer price index. Computer glitch locks workers out, security system problem, and numerous other things from all over the world, including London and so forth. The problems are continuing. They haven't gone away. Here's one of the latest articles that I got that kind of alarms me, and I knew that this would come. It says, at this point, many simply giving up on year 2000 testing, which means they're changing the code, but they're not able to test it, so they're just moving it into production. That's going to mean problems. The current concern from a worldly standpoint on this is, first of all, panic. There's a lot of concern in the federal government on that very thing. Another thing is hoarding. Another thing is violence. Now, if you talk to our fundamentalist friends, they are focusing in on this is the return of Christ. He's going to return. The new millennium is going to come up, and they're going to have a thousand-year reign. If you turn to the friends in the world that are not religious, a lot of them are practicing or planning for escapism. They're going to go somewhere and get away from this. There's a lady in my office that's going to go. She's got her guns and all of her other things. She's going to go to southern New Mexico and farm in the desert. We're waiting for the blossoms there. Next month in March, ABC has a special featuring Robert Stack and Peter Graves entitled The Year 2000 Crisis. It's a one-hour show. So this is going to raise awareness as well. This is what's happening in the world. It's pretty distressing from a fleshly standpoint. But we realize it's a problem. You know, it could be year 2000, could be stock market crashes, could be whatever the next problem is, right? Impeachment. But the Lord gives us a better perspective. In John 16:33, we read, "These things I have spoken unto you, that you might have peace." He's talking about peace under adverse conditions. He's not talking about peace when you're on vacation and you're in a beautiful forest and you're having a picnic. Anybody can have peace there. He's talking about peace when you have turmoil in your life, when you're not feeling well, when you're suffering from sickness, adversity, trouble on the job, so on and so forth. You can have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. This shows us what the focus of our perspective should be. You know, we could go on to whatever the next headline is. War in Korea or whatever. You know, we don't know what the next headline will be, but what we're pointing out here is there's different perspectives you can take. And we need to look at each of these events critically from a spiritual perspective. Now, this time of year especially, our thoughts turn to Memorial. And we think about preparing for Memorial just as they did for the Passover, getting the leaven out. And one of the things that we have to do in that preparation, and it's difficult, I think Brother Ed last week talked about, working for Jewish people where they had two refrigerators, two stoves, two this, two that. One was for leaven, one was unleavened. We've got to get the leaven out. And so the way we do that is by changing our habits. Now, we get reminded of this at special events like our watch night service. We all kind of really reflect on what's happened in the last year and the things that will come in the next year. And the other time I find is our focus as we approach the memorial. And there's a reprint that I'll give you. It's 5908 through 5909. And this is something that Brother Emil Hersher gave us a number of years back. He gave us a little card that was made up with a poem from this reprint article. I think it's very true. It's based on Philippians 4:8. We are or tend to become what we think. Very simple statement. So it's basically saying what starts out here has an effect on what we become. And here's the little poem that goes along with that. Sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. It's showing us from the very smallest part, just the thought. I thought I might go and do this afternoon. That's going to wreak an act. Now, if I start to do that repetitively, like after meeting, I like to go and get the Sunday paper. That's become a habit now because I do it repetitively. And our habits over time in a cumulative effect determine our character, and ultimately our character determines our destiny. Here's a kind of a roadmap of human character. So you say, well, what if I want to change things? And the question that was posed on this little card from Brother Emil was, what kind of people do we want to be? And what he's saying here is make a conscious decision of where you want to go. Where is it you want to go? Don't let it be the default. He's saying make a conscious decision. If you say, I'm going to let it be the default, it's going to fall back to the arm of the flesh. Because we all are fleshly beings. But what kind of people do we want to be? Put on our spiritual eyesight and set spiritual goals. It continues. It all starts in the mind. Think right and be more Christ-like. Now, I've got a little handout here that I'll give you. You know, it'd be really nice if in the scriptures on a certain page or chapter, you could turn to there and it kind of gave you a checklist. Anybody like checklists? I really do. Well, I'm going to give you somewhat of a checklist. And this is a checklist of that we did a few years ago. I think I left myself one up here. And I was involved at General Convention with the 18 to 29-year-olds, and we worked on a spiritual good habit checklist. And as you're handing these out, I'll just explain a few things. First of all, psychologists tell us it takes 14 days to develop a new habit. And if you've done it for 14 days, then it kind of becomes the norm. So if you want to take up walking, if you do it for about 2 weeks vigorously, then you'll probably stay in the habit, at least till your next vacation, then you fall out of that good habit. And it's the same way with our spiritual habits. We can get in good spiritual habits, then something happens, and we get out of those habits. Now, not too long ago, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I had what we call our annual review at work. And that's kind of a good thing because that's where the boss lines up what he thinks you did with what he thinks you ought to have done and tells you how you really did and what you're going to get or not get. Well, with regards to God, God doesn't do that kind of thing. He depends on us to do self-evaluation. And one of the ways that we can form a good character is by developing good habits, right along with Brother Emil's excerpt there. If we have good thoughts and we have good acts and we reap good habits, the accumulation of those will be a good character, which will determine our destiny. So we thought what we would do with the few minutes that are remaining is just review some of these things. And you'll notice a very important part of this sheet. First of all, it's self-evaluation. Now, I could give this to my wife, but, you know, some of these things you have to evaluate based on your own heart. And some of these things, when you do evaluation, you're not going to like what you find out. Did you ever find that out? You know, when I first started speaking, I said to my wife, okay, tell me what I did wrong. And I really didn't want to hear what I did wrong, but I asked. But, you know, it's kind of like life's experiences. You grow and develop. My wife said, when you talk, you always drop off it. And then nobody can hear what you say. So I try to get around that. I, you know, after about 10 times of telling, or after 14 times of telling me that, hopefully I don't do that anymore. So the type of things that we have here are things that we think are generally good habits. And we've given you some scriptural references to support that. But obviously each and every one of us has to do the evaluation themselves. Now, one of the things you'll notice on the forms under each section is there's some blank lines. So hopefully, if you don't like these, you know, what we said to the young people was mark through them. If that one doesn't sound right to you or you have some other ones you want to add in, put them in and then also put your scriptural support. Because we realize we don't want to do this as a result of so-and-so said this is a good habit, therefore I'm going to do it. We have to prove all things. So some of the things that we generally broke into different categories. Prayer, study, and meditation. Pray upon waking, at midday, and before going to sleep. Very, very good advice. Sometimes it's very, very hard to follow. How many of you said a prayer upon waking Well, you don't have to raise your hands because we don't want to embarrass anybody. I missed that this morning, but I got up at 2:55, so maybe there's a little allowance there. But think about it and then evaluate yourself. And what you can do is if that's a habit you want to reinforce that maybe you've gotten a little sloppy on, you can go back and then check yourself in a couple of weeks and try to develop a good habit. Start at the start of the day and the end of the day with a spiritual reading and devotion. And we have the manna and the songs. And those are two good things. And if you have a spouse, it's good to share those things together if you can. Now, if you get up at different times in the morning, maybe you can't do that. You do it on the way to work or at breakfast. And then in the evening, you can read the songs together, and that's a nice way to close the day. Pray before each meal, regardless of location. And this is kind of a tough one, especially for our younger people, because sometimes you may be a little bit, you're in a public place and you say a prayer, and you bow your head. You know, I've gotten a number of comments by doing this, especially in public restaurants. I've had people come up and say, well, you know, that's really wonderful that you give a prayer before you eat. Very good example. We should be thankful for all of the necessities of life that the Lord has provided. Pray for others, the brethren in the world, daily. Do it on a daily basis. We have brethren in India right now. We have brethren in Sacramento right now. We have brethren in North Carolina. We have brethren in St. Petersburg. And where else? Have we been Miami? Have we said a special prayer for them? Daily spend more time on study and spiritual feeding than eating meals. Now, you know, there's nowhere in the scriptures that I've found that says, well, how much time a day should you study? But, you know, if we spend an hour and a half a day eating natural food, could we draw a correlation that we should spend at least an hour and a half partaking of spiritual food? I mean, this is not a hard and fast rule, and if you don't like it, that's fine. But I find it's a nice rule of thumb. Spend as much time in spiritual study and reading as you do in eating. Daily study and meditate on spiritual things. Pick a subject, delve into a question, exercise your mind. We know that we're all leaky vessels, so this helps us to focus on the important things of life. Prefer reading spiritual materials over worldly materials. Everybody, this is one I've got to work on some more. I mean, I like to read truth materials, but I'm reading technical journals and all sorts of other things as well. But we should prefer reading spiritual things over worldly things. Listen to a truth talk or music while driving to work or during your spare time. Now, everybody's lives are different, but I found that it's very uplifting if you listen to a talk going into work and coming back or whatever your routine is. Maybe it's you're in the kitchen doing dishes. Whatever that routine is, take some time to listen to a talk, and it really solidifies it in your mind. And the wonderful thing about listening to them on tape, you know, I've been listening to one from David Duran on chronology for a long time. I bet I've listened to that tape 30 or 40 times. It's finally sinking in. You can repeat it over and over again on a talk. You can also select a talk. I remember Dominic Destro gave a wonderful talk on what's the use of worrying. Let's say you're particularly worried, go and find that tape and pull it out and listen to it over and over again. Very helpful. Evaluates the day's successes and failures at the close of the day. Self-evaluation is not easy. When we look at our lives, when we look at from a spiritual perspective, we realize we've had some successes. Every one of you made it to meeting today. That's a wonderful success. It's not easy on a Sunday morning. But we love the Lord, and we love to get here if we possibly can. But there are also failures that we have during the day, omissions and commissions. And we've got to review those within ourselves and work on how can I avoid getting into that habit again. Some character and fruitage habits that might help out. Have I grown spiritually during the past week, month, day, week, month, and year? Do I seek to rejoice in the Lord's will in all of my daily affairs? And we should probably have capital all here. You know, it's real easy to rejoice when things are going our way. But when things are the pits at work and they're railing on you because something's not right and you've got to fix it yesterday, can we rejoice in that? That's a very tough thing. Can we demonstrate self-control in all life's matters? Road rage is not an option. I mean, but there's a lot of little things. Do we have self-control? We have that proverb scripture about that. Put as many obstacles as possible between myself and evil. You know, there's a biblical principle called avoidance, and it works real well. If you have a weakness or a tendency, put as many obstacles or as you can in the way of that so that you can avoid getting into that snare. Minimize worldly entanglements in worldly affairs. Do all things with thoroughness and zealousness. And I really like that scripture of doing all unto the Lord, whether it's taking out the trash, doing the dishes, whatever it is, doing the lawn, doing something complex at work, do all as unto the Lord. Treat others with love, respect, gentleness, and kindness. This is one that I really have to work on. I find as a senior technician at work, sometimes the gentleness and kindness may not be there. And especially by those around us. Remember, if they're not gentle and kind, that can be a little infectious. So we've got to try to continue in that. Demonstrate patience during the whole day. I will be patient. Study and prepare before and participate in meetings. I think we've shown that today. It was good participation. Attend meetings and fellowship with the brethren as opportunities arise. You know, parts of this, Ernie gave a talk not too long after New Year's on good habits. A lot of these you're going to see are flowing right back into there. Encourage widows, the sick, and isolated. We have many opportunities to do that. If you can't see them by going in, you've got the phone, you've got letters, you've got email. We have many, many vehicles to do this. Take advantage of it. Daily sacrifice on behalf of the Lord. Boy, that's a tough one. What was your sacrifice yesterday on behalf of the Lord? I'm not asking to raise a hand or go out loud, but think about it, especially at the end of the day. What did I sacrifice? If we do that every day, it's like the Scout motto, do a good turn daily. When you do a good turn daily, it kind of becomes automatic. And sacrifice can become automatic as well, to where it's a habit and you just go ahead and do it. Daily be faithful to my vows to the Lord and obedient to His will. That's another tough one. That old fleshly will keeps coming up. We have our own preferences and desires, but we're told that we have to submit to the Lord's will. Let another fully express their viewpoint before speaking. I think my wife must have put this one in. But this is another tendency, especially the men tend to have, is we tend to engage our mouths before we hear the whole thing. That's really not appropriate. Resolve disputes before the end of the day. More good advice. Visit widows and the infirm, both brethren and friends. Don't be critical and judgmental of others. And I like to think of this as we need to have a Christian coaching mentality. We need to encourage the brethren and not tear them down. There's enough criticism. I mean, we can let them know where we stand. Another one, daily witness to the truth in conversation, action, and example. You know, we don't always have an opportunity to witness verbally, but sometimes our example is very much noticed. Especially in the work situation, they notice that you pray before meals. They notice that you you handle people gently, even when they're abusive to you. They notice your example and demeanor. They notice your language. Build up each other's with constructive praise. Greet the brethren with a handshake or hug and a kiss. And if you're in Europe, you've got to know the number of kisses based on which country they're coming from. It's kind of interesting. Daily convey love to the brethren, to family and friends. And I think we all do a good job of that based on our many meetings and the love that's brought. Allow others to go before you. this is kind of something I have a problem with. The bowl mentality says I go through first or I do this first. But go to the back of the line or let others go before you. Do a good turn daily, especially to the household of faith. Finally, some positive lifestyle habits. Eat 3 balanced meals without over or under consumption. And the basis of this is if you're not healthy and happy from a fleshly standpoint, it makes these other things much more difficult. Get exercise every other day. Minimize time for worldly entertainment. It's another tough one. Minimize distractions of the flesh and time wasters. For those of you who have unlimited internet access, I think that goes under this category. It can be a distraction and a time waster, and obtain sufficient rest. So those are some positive lifestyle changes. Now, you can keep the sheet and make whatever you would like out of it. Hopefully you'll go through and change it or add new additional scriptures or add different categories. It's important that throughout life and as we look at events that we maintain a spiritual perspective. There will always be something. Market crash, impeachment trial, distracting holidays, year 2000, the list goes on. We live in perilous times. We cannot allow these times and these events to change our focus. We can't allow these times and events to shift our energies. This stuff in the world, if you think about it, all this time that they spent on the impeachment, all this time that they, and all the talking and all the energy, was a whole lot of nothing when we look at it from a spiritual perspective. The only thing it profited is if we can look at that situation and see God's hand working in the situation. If we focus on spiritual things, then the things of the flesh will take care of themselves. This is the most important work of our time. In fact, if the press really knew what was important, they would be focusing in on the final footstep members of the church. Because the work that they're doing is much more important than anything Kenneth Starr did, anything Bill Clinton did, anything the Pope did. The most important focus should be on the spiritual things rather than the things of the flesh. Now, what is the will of God concerning you? We're given this in Romans 12:2. We're all familiar with this. It reads, "And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God." What does God want? There's 2 places in the scriptures where it states, "This is the will of God concerning you." And one of them is in 1 Thessalonians 5:8. "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you." Thankfulness, that's simple. Second, 1 Thessalonians 4:3. "For this is the will of God, even your sanctification." That's it. Sanctification means to be made holy. The way that's done is through our habits and through keeping a spiritual perspective. May each of us seek to serve Him acceptably. For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To Him be the glory forever. Amen.